I can have your attention, please. I'd like to welcome everyone to this evening's edition of the Dallas Philosopher Forum Lecture Series. Great to see a lot of familiar faces and a few new faces. Hope everybody makes themselves welcome and meets a few new folks. This is an organization that has been going strong for 30 plus years, more or less doing the same thing, which is 32, according to our esteemed historian Bob Berman. 32 years doing more or less the same thing, which is bringing topics of philosophical and intellectual interest to an interested lay audience in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. And we are a purely nonprofit, all-volunteer organization. We don't sponsor any particular worldview. In fact, there's quite a diversity of worldview among our directors, but we believe in being able to find out about a lot of different perspectives and vantage points in a comfortable, inquisitive forum. So that's why we're here. And I'd like to encourage you, if you didn't get to stop by and make a contribution on your way in, to see Rob Olson. He's our president, but acting as treasurer tonight. And we request a $5 admission fee to defray our expenses of publicity and equipment and so on. Like I said, we are a nonprofit, but we do have certain expenses. And if you'd like to become a subscriber for $35, you can get a six-month subscription. That'll be close to half the price if you want to be a long-term participant. We have a... Somebody's looking at music. We have a very kind of fun event coming up this summer. On July 22nd, we'll be doing Philosophy Jeopardy out at SMU. There will be three teams from TCU, UTA, University of Dallas. I'm sorry, SMU. Help me here. SMU, University of Dallas, and
UTA.
We'll be participating based on the popular TV show Jeopardy, except that the topics will all be philosophical topics that they'll be answering, and they'll be competing for cash prizes to their philosophy department. And to kind of help raise the kitty for those prizes, we would encourage anybody that's so inclined to become a sponsor of the program. There's several different levels of that, but as a sponsor, you'll get your name and or your business card in the program publicity materials, and it's a great cause to support. These philosophy departments, you know, operate on a constrained budget, and I'm sure it'd be nice for them to have a little bit of departmental funds to put to good use. And I would encourage you to settle up with El Phoenix here on your food, including being generous to your waitstaff. We occasionally, including recently, have a few people that are inattentive and walk out without paying their bill. And when that happens, that comes back out of our treasury and reduces the funds we have to operate with. So we would encourage you to do the right thing and settle up on your way out. Okay, I think that's all of our administrative. So to the delights of the evening at hand, we welcome Erling Beck as our presenter tonight. Mr. Beck obtained a Master of Science in Chemistry from UTD and currently serves as a research associate at the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center School of Pharmacy here in Dallas. He is a member of the American Chemical Society, the American Association of Pharmaceutical Scientists, the American Society for Mass Spectrometry, the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry, and the Materials Research Society. And also claims to be on the board of directors of the North Texas Skeptics, but I'm not real sure we should accept that particular claim. And as author or co-author, has written a string of articles, none of which I can pronounce, so I won't try, but they all sound like chemistry to me. So no further ado, I give you Erling Beck.
Thank you very much.
Can you hear me?
Now we can.
Well, I was trying to frame this presentation in a way where it would tie up what we now call skepticism, at least since as defined in the movement by when Paul Gardner published his book in 1950, approximately, called Facts and Fallacies in the Name of Science. After that period, several organizations started to appear that would promote skepticism as a form of combating pseudoscience, alternative medicine treatments that fail. There's a joke with the skeptics of alternative medicine that if the alternative medicine works, it's called medicine. The other reason was to fight the exploitation of the psychics and they would exploit the grief of people for profit, you know, giving them false hope. But we have to understand that the pillars of skepticism are much older than that. And even though I'm not going to be able to explain I won't be able to explain maybe in the language that a philosopher would understand the jargon, you know, or even an enthusiast of philosophy as myself. I'm gonna present this topic in a way in which I understand it. So I'm gonna be incorrect, but I'm gonna present an outline starting from the Greek philosophy. Mentioned the Middle Ages, and it's going to be, in a way, a narrative that is not that accurate, but, you know, it's a skepticism, so you can be skeptical of my historicity. And then, the rediscovery of skepticism in the Renaissance and what happened thereafter. Because I believe that in practice, philosophy jumps. It's not tied to the paradigms or a certain school in the same way maybe an academic philosopher would believe it is. Now, that would mean that in some cases, yes, some different schools of philosophy would contradict each other. But maybe that's okay, you know? When we reach the end of this talk, I hope that I've conveyed that at least the way that the activists now that are skeptical inquirers practice skepticism to debunk claims and pseudoscience and other important subjects, or how they investigate the probability of other subjects is, you know, it borrows a lot from different schools of philosophy, but maybe all along, skepticism is the best way to start those type of inquiries, because in most cases, it's more likely that something's going to be the null hypothesis. So, and I think it's because there's more wrong explanations to something than there are correct ones. Now, since I'm a lay person in philosophical terms, and I'm not a professional mentalist or magician, I would like to know, if there's time, we could test a concept at the end, hopefully. I'll ask for volunteers when we get there. And I'm going to maybe try to prove my point. And, skepticism has its roots in Greek philosophy from two schools. Inspired by the works of Socrates in the 5th century, from his words, "All I know that I know nothing," Plato forms his academy and he and his students of the Platonic Academy draw on the teachings on Socrates to distinguish between two subjects, episteme and doxa, which is knowledge and opinion. They accept that skepticism accepts the limits of our senses and our reasoning as unreliable. They are the way they frame it as if we get knowledge from our senses and our reasoning and they're unreliable, we can never achieve absolute knowledge. Pyrrho the Elis is considered the quintessential philosopher, the founder of skepticism as we know it today. And he has been described as a complete doubter, especially in ethical matters. He was the first one to express skepticism in how we make our claims in ethics that to this day are stable and especially when it reemerges in other forms as the skeptical morality, the skepticism of morality and stuff like that. His approach in the realm of knowledge, especially in the realm of values, led him to least express a form of anguish and unhappiness. And to prevent this, he proposed the concept of ataraxia, which could be expressed in many forms. In my words, it would be something like peace of mind, or inner peace, or something like, or something of sorts. The Greeks, for the Greek, this is more of unperturbedness. I think that would be the closest translation. But just like Socrates survived mostly by the writings of Plato and subsequent influence and other philosophers, the same happened to the writings of Pyrrho. And they were perpetrated thanks to the efforts of Anaxidemus. End of the, he was born in 100 to 40 before Christ. So he died maybe less than 50 years before the Common Era. His followers adopted the term skeptic, that derived from the words skepticos and doubter, which was epithecus. Today, a skeptic is, I think, thought of as a denialist in some cases, debunker or maybe a cynic, particularly in matters of ethics. But it seems to have been lost in translation that the word skeptic also has roots in inquiry. And this is the distinction that really made both schools of skepticism to be different, the academic skepticism and the Pyrrhonic skepticism. They both accepted that there were limits to knowledge, but the academic skeptics made the claim that knowledge, absolute truth or knowledge in this form can never be known. And the Pyrrhonic skeptics at the time pointed out that this indeed is a knowledge claim and it is self-centrally true. So what could have been a very productive fight against dogmatism became a sort of a rivalry by that small distinction. So I guess what happens is that the Pyrrhonic skeptics decided that it's better to have at least some amount of knowledge than none, and made inquiry, even if you never reach complete knowledge, part of the ethos. The teachings of Pyrrhus would have disappeared for a long time if not written by Sextus Empiricus, who wrote the Outlines of Skepticism, and the work still has survived over the centuries. He wrote this sometimes around the mid-second century AD. And it wouldn't be discovered for some time. Been transmitted by his disciples in the Greek language for centuries until it was translated to the Latin when Rome was an empire. This wouldn't happen yet. The skepticism in the Middle Ages, while these philosophers never became never called themselves skeptics, they had both academic and Pyrrhonians, schools of skepticism had survived. But the main thinkers at the time would at least either know Latin or write in Latin. Basically, Roman or Greek that knew Latin. It was pretty much like how English has the cultural hegemony today. And even though that they don't draw directly from the manuscripts of the Pyrrhonic skeptics, then we can see the spirit of skepticism living alive and well in their thinking. I will quote directly from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. This quote on medieval skepticism. Chronologically speaking, skeptical issues were most prominently considered in the works, both leading and the tail end of the middle century. Augustine's 4th and 5th century attacks against academic skeptics mark the beginnings of such discussions. And as Maturin treatments of skeptical issues appear periodically throughout the next 800 years. From the late 13th century onward, however, skeptical issues began to exert a dominant and wide influence on epistemological discussions. As seen in the works of such important figures such as Henry Gent, John Duns, Scholes, William Holcomb, Peter Uriel, John Weirden, and Nicholas Outrecourt. This is where I, and hopefully somebody can correct me, because this is where my limitations on the subject matter may make me say something really stupid. But from the way I researched the subject, it seems that Christian theologians like St. Augustine adopted Greek and Roman intellectual traditions. That, you know, that's not debatable. To argue in matters of faith. By applying it, from the way I understand it, methods not only from the academic tradition of a skepticism, but also the dogmatic other philosophers, they would accept the claim that that yes, knowledge is incomplete, knowledge is unreliable for most things, but in matters of faith, you can actually trust in that type of knowledge as true. So, at least in my reading, it seems that this is one case in which different schools of philosophy are incompatible, but people find a way to merge them to support their claims. And it's also in this period that the word dogma changes from what in the Greek language would be considered some type of true knowledge or concepts like Platonic concepts, like the perfect circle, something like that, to have the connotations that it does as the dogma does through a true doctrine when it comes to religious matters. I have to say that also some important contributions of to Islamic and U.S. philosopher at the time were made, but they're outside the scope probably of this presentation. And from hereafter, we go to the skepticism in the Renaissance. It's around 1562 of our era that the first influential translation to the Latin language of the outlines of Pyrrhonism are known to the Roman culture, and they quickly disseminate in a way that some scholars call a crisis in the thinking. And here is where we find Michel de Montaigne and René Descartes and Francis Bacon. They were directly influenced by the philosophical writing of the Outlines of Pyrrhonism that were written 200 years before the Common Era, so that would be 700 years before them, in the 2nd century AD. No, it would be, 1300 years. And they have a quickly spread like gunpowder all over Europe. From here is that we, René Descartes establishes methodological or Cartesian skepticism. Bacon sets the pillars for the scientific method in firm foundation. And Hume starts also applying these concepts to matters of empiricism and the most famous philosophical doctrine by Hume, which is the induction problem. I do have to mention also an interesting concept here when Michel de Montaigne, he uses them, Pyrrhonic skepticism, in the same way that in the Middle Ages the theologians used academic skepticism to establish doubt in true knowledge by except in matters of faith. In a way that at least some historians describe his acceptance of Pyrrhonic skepticism only as so far as it makes it doubts every other claim except claims that would open the door to promote his Catholicism at the time. So it's quite interesting. Two schools that were thought to be in complete disagreement in the Greek era being used their arguments to promote faith, while both types of schools contradicted each other. And Descartes also, even as he postulated some of the most radical forms of skepticism, he also didn't go as far as to deny the existence of God. That he wouldn't cross that boundary. But after this, becomes rediscovered form of thinking, the quickly, the way that human knowledge is taken from concepts, from the ivory tower, from the thinkers, into a way that they benefit society is quickly achieved. And I think the reason for this, in large part, may be due to the fact that the Pyrrhonic skepticism was and has been compatible with what later became known as the scientific method, another concept that is not well defined in any way. But it seems that at least the scientists today can live with the idea of not achieving ataraxia and conduct the research in a way that they know that it may be proven wrong later, and that is incomplete. Here thereafter, other philosophers also were influenced by the writings of the Pyrrhonic, like Kant and Nietzsche, too, in a less indirect way. And it seems that thereafter, the boundaries of skepticism become more nebulous. It has become such an important method of inquiry that at least I know of one academic journal that publishes exclusively on skepticism, and numerous books have written about it. Definitely, in a way that sadly, after maybe, I think when I think that scientists now know that they don't know where the roots of their method of inquiry, at least the philosophy behind science, comes from, but it's influenced by Pyrrhonic skepticism. And that has to do, in many ways, with the regretfully sad events that led to the scientists and the thinkers in humanities become separated by some artificial boundary. And in some ways, some of the philosophies that happen in that are more relativistic in nature, postmodernism and other sorts of philosophy that rejected the validity of scientific claims. But before this happens, then there's a division between the academic philosophers and the philosophers that is now that and the activists that are now in numerous organizations around the world, such as the North Texas Skeptics, which is the organization I represent. From here, we start drawing from other philosophers like Popper. We start drawing from philosophies like analytical philosophy and other contributions. It doesn't seem, at least, that neither practicing scientists or people that do skeptical activism, like myself, even notice that they are applying these types of philosophy. It happened. A series of events led to this. In 1950, like I mentioned earlier, Martin Gardner, a polymath and all this also the well mathematician that had a long lasting column in the Scientific American, published a book that was ignored. It was called In the Name of Science, and the book didn't sell anything. Another publisher took it a few years later and reprinted the book, resulting in a masses of success that made Martin Gardner a household item, at least for the type of people that would read American Scientific American. In this book, which is a pop science book, he starts describing pseudoscience. Paranormal phenomena. And at this point also, because by the beginning of the 20th century and end of the 19th century, spiritualism took a hold in Europe, particularly in England. And one of the missions of the one of the concerns of the people at the time was to debunk the claims of spiritualism. After Gardner publishes his book, when we start hearing people calling themselves skeptics, are people from different backgrounds. But even then, some scientists start joining and forming in the debunking. One of them was the great Carl Sagan, which now his series called Cosmos have been revived by the excellent efforts of Neil deGrasse Tyson and as executive producer, the guy from Family Guy. We also have the contributions of the people that were interested in this type of communication as a form of consumer protection. We have scientists like Richard Feynman. We also have some interesting entertainers. The first one, even predating Gardner, was Houdini. And he would go and challenge and debunk, destroying the careers, rightfully so, of spiritualists, and exposing their methods. By the 70s, one of the of these magicians starts noticing the scam going on and becoming more popular in our culture, and his name was James Randi. Now, I won't mention much about James Randi because his movie, documentary about his life is coming out soon. And I think apparently it's already getting standing ovations in the, I think it's the Tribeca Film Festival, the one that is ongoing right now, so let me alter any person that is either Tribeca or the one in, well. And aside, if I'm able to, I'm going to try to get a screening, so you are all invited. But what I'm going to say about Randi is that Randi, at least in my favorite philosopher, he did contribute something that I can't undervalue. I mean, I can't overvalue. And it's the concept that, and it's a lesson that has been lost, that, you know, the scientists have the ultimate word on a subject. And sometimes this type what is that word when that's a unwarranted intellectual superiority.
Arrogance,
yeah. A couple of things are worthy to mention here. At the time that Uri Geller, for example, became famous, scientists started to talk about the demarcation about parapsychology as a science, and started giving it scientific credibility. Now, they did get a lot of interesting results in concerning parapsychology, but the results couldn't be reproduced. Or, if the controls were made tougher, the experiments would start to fail. The other problem was that the results were always in that margin where they're not significantly, statistically, or if they are, they're just barely. This is what now called the demarcation problem in science, but it doesn't. For a lot of research, it doesn't have to be that way. Randi offered many times to research his services as a consultant to be present when these experiments are done. As a professional magician, Randi could have spotted many ways in which the psychics, for example, were achieving positive results, at least when the controls went down and they were allowed some leeway. And they never took him up on his offers, resulting in a scandal that was called the Alpha Boys, Young teenagers were trained by Randi, and they infiltrated I think Harold Clark's lab on parapsychology research, and did all kinds of amazing things that even famous scam artists like Uri Geller weren't able to do, including driving a car while blindfolded and other fantastic stuff. Randi would still communicate with the researchers and tell them that that they could be doing this particular effect to achieve the trick basically sending the sending the he would send his own basically saying how his own saboteurs were achieving the positive results in parapsychology, and then contacting the main researcher and telling him how to spot it, and they wouldn't listen. Eventually, after 3 years of doing this, they came out and they did a press release and revealed that they had been all along, making those results in parapsychology possible. And the field never really recovered. But not before millions of dollars were wasted in an unproductive enterprise. The other thing that I really touched Randy was growing up and going to as a Catholic in Canada, going to the shop where they would sell commemorative relics from the Vatican, or not relics, they were not really relics, but they were, the claim was that they came directly from Rome, from the Vatican. And noticing that they had a Made in China sign in it. So by the 80s, he's an adult, and he and other philosophers at the time, and other scientists now, now that skepticism is more now more democratic along other disciplines, decide to form the first organization dedicated to paranormal research, and it was called the Committee for Committee for Skeptical Inquiry of Paranormal Claims. And they started attacking the claims of the faith healers, which at the time one of the persons that got debunked is already back in business. Have you seen him, Peter Popoff? The miracle water guy. He was debunked by Randy too, and if you don't know the event, you probably want to see the movie. But Johnny Carson was also an amateur magician, and Johnny Carson also had Uri Geller on the show, and Randy set him up so he couldn't do the spoon bending trick, and he failed completely on national television. From this, Uri Geller put us a lawsuit, and Randy, which was working by Psychop at the time, had to defend himself, and because Psychop also was confronting a lawsuit. Many feel that this was a mistake, because the organization should have supported him, but this allowed Randy to do his own educational foundation, and Psychop maybe start thinking about humanism and other stuff. And when this it was over, Randy Educational Foundation has $1 million for anyone that can prove that a paranormal claim is true, with controls, with methods of, scientific, how you would conduct a scientific experiment. And SciPa and other organizations like the Skeptical organization, the one founded by Michael Shermer in the 90s, decided that they were going to focus on claims that could be testable, so they didn't dare to touch religion. At this point, organizations such like the one I represent, because this is one of the oldest in Texas, also became separated from the main psychop organization, and that ethos remained. Now, it is true that that we can live by the principles of the non-overlapping magisteria, which was the compromise that biologist Stephen Jay Gould did on the subject. But at the same time, the faith healers that were debunked in the late 80s were coming back. And other forms of abuse by the religious were having a lot of impact on the lives of other people. And then there's the obvious cults. I mean, who that doesn't know the history of Scientology wouldn't have some concerns on the subject, especially because in some particular belief forms, you get isolated from even questioning that type of dogma. It's at this point that in the 90s, PsyCop decided to change its name to Center for Inquiry. And here we finally see a philosopher putting forward a new form of skepticism again, and about time. So we have this time from the beginning of the 20th century to near the end, where skepticism is, as a philosophy, is really thought of in academic circles by academics and journals, and then a change from people debunking Sylvia Brown, for example, also a Randy object, to now broadening these terms. And this was great. He wrote a book called, among the 30 other books that he wrote, called The New Skepticism. And before I even read it, because when I started doing the North Texas Skeptics activities, I was thinking, how long is this going to last? The idea of skeptical thinking has to continue as a philosophy or as a way of obtaining at least determining some form of reliable knowledge on different claims. What is the use of these organizations and like the one I represent in practical terms? And I think it's becoming obsolete. No, I mean, it's not that they are becoming obsolete. They're probably needed more than ever. But it's to become obsolete. That's what I mean. It seems that even though skeptical thinking yields many products that are useful at adopting skeptical thinking, it goes contrary to the way we feel. And just by my notes, we can see this happening. Even since Pilo, I mean, or even since the academic skeptics, if you notice, the only real difference is the academic skeptics and the Pyrrhonic skeptics is that the Pyrrhonic skeptics incorporated inquiry also. Now, the concept that we can't really achieve that absolute truth is, how much time do I have?
About 7 minutes.
Okay, we know that inside of us, but we can either decide to just give up or accept that there's some degrees of probabilities we're gonna get it wrong. And what he proposed in that New Skepticism book, and then he had a few years after start thinking about applying these concepts in other areas, including economic philosophy, nobody even thought of. By the time he was dead already, behavioral economics was getting a foothold. And then we see empirically that perhaps the Keynesian school the free market school, they're flawed. And they can be tested empirically, because on one side, you can't really predict how a population is going to react to centralized initiative, like for example a government, but at the same time it's not, even in a free market you get a lot of chaos, and not everything results from thinking in terms of self-benefit. He also thinks that he decides to also maybe start, not in the way the new atheism did it, but start challenging some terms that have a lot of consequences made by religious people. In fact, I know I posted this on our meetup site, but this is in the message boards, so maybe some of you missed it in the meetup. But new people start emerging also, like Peter Boghossian. I see some people here that went to that presentation. Now, I have a sister that is in the church as a pastor, but at the same time, I think these questions have to be made. And I invited him, and he came here, and he presented all over the Metroplex. His claim is that you can treat faith as an epistemology. And if he's right, which I'll leave that to philosophers and theologians to debate, well, then it's probably not that reliable. And then there's other claims, also bad advice in medicine, for example. Those are also claims from skepticism. So now we have a world open of possibilities, open for people that do this type of skeptical activism. But I'm going to end the presentation saying that I think that the main problem is an oversensibility to realizing that we don't know, and maybe we're too scared of the ataraxia that not knowing it is in itself a knowledge that we should embrace. So I think that now I'm going to do something that this could fail. How much time do I have?
A couple minutes.
Couple of minutes. Before I go, I want to say something. I've never been here before. But let's see if this works. And you, if I get negative results, well, I don't do this professionally. I've done it a couple of times. But have you heard about cold reading? Okay, cold reading. What if I need two chances. Let me see. What if I say somebody here has a granddaughter that is having, or maybe a niece, that is having doubts about vaccinating her children? Would somebody raise a hand? But the way it's not a vaccine denialism position. It seems like concerned with the vaccination schedule. Too many vaccines at the same time. Does that ring a bell? A neighbor? No?
It's a very common worry.
It is. Okay, let me try another one. So I'm inferring a lot of things from this crowd. Concerns, okay. I'm a centrist, right? So I take skeptically any claim from either the left or the right. There's one subject that is going to be a subject that is either going to end up really bad or hopefully, you know, the press is wrong. And it's this subject of global warming. Now, I don't think that there's, because skepticism overlaps a lot with denialism, but there's a particular preoccupation, and that's the one if the models are wrong. Would anyone identify with that? What if the models, not if it's man-made or not.
Right here. Yeah,
excellent. Well, you're hard. You're really hard to, you know, the psychic way is really hard to, because I was feeling them more in that area.
Okay. Guided crossing would be a better time.
All right. Let's see if I can get something else. The turning point for you was maybe. Was it the Isangia email? Maybe. Did you recall anything from that incident? Because let's say I feel right now, or I read some betrayal. Your aha moment, was that, have you slowly been reaching that conclusion? Or are you distancing yourself from that conclusion, but that remains a doubt?
Slowly reaching the conclusion.
All right. Well, I also feel that this is there's a tendency in the press to exaggerate claims. That's how we got to the other fundamental preoccupation that very smart people like this group has, which is the vaccine thing. Now, if somebody tells me at the end of the presentation that they identify with that, somebody they know that time, they can tell me later. Because it's also a controversial issue. But on the other hand, there's the press works in a way that that will show the exception as the rule. And when you start hearing too many things in the press, you don't know if it's a moral panic, right? If you're being manipulated into fear.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But you know at the same time that you can trust the press. I mean, not the whole press is in a conspiracy. So, so if I define this preoccupation, it would be really wait and see, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Well, this is the thing. I cannot tell you how I knew that much about you, because it's a trade secret from, you know, the directors of Skeptical Inquiry. But I am going to tell you that if we ask a few people here that want to contribute their opinion on how I did it, they're going to come to many conclusions. And if you guys want to, we can open the floor for questions, and you can start maybe telling me how you think I did it. Go for it.
Who wants the first question?
So I'll respond to your question first, and then I'll ask you a question. Your question was how you what was your method? It seems like you were picking hot button issues and making generalized comments about those hot button issues that most people would identify with if they followed. It's pretty simple.
Yeah, it's that simple. Yes, that is the that's precisely the yes, it is true. It feels that way. But had I done it that way, I would have put myself in a position of maybe making a bigger embarrassment of myself.
Always. So, I have a good friend who's actually a mind reader. And we talk about this all the time.
Well, exactly. But yeah, the generalized statement is also an explanation, but I want to hear more. Because After that, I'm probably going to conclude the point I'm trying to make. Any other writer up there?
Yeah, I have a more general question. I'm hoping, as science and information become more dispersed, and science is becoming extremely advanced, that most high schoolers can comprehend a lot of the ideas and the innovation that's been done. And it seems that as information becomes more accessible, people are becoming more suspect of the science. So how do we communicate these scientific ideas to laymen when they are less skeptical of the actual ideas? Because we come across as skeptics as very obnoxious. And we don't seem to be able to communicate the ideas in a way that regular people can comprehend, where Fox News is selling them all this pop science stuff, and they believe it more than they believe in us.
Yes, that's an important question. And that has to do with knowing your limits. I mean, maybe one of the biggest problems that we have when it comes to being skeptical or trying to how we think about our own ignorance. It's a big problem in not knowing our limitations. My limitation is that I think that I can work as a research scientist and drive in data traffic and still be here on time. You see? So we think more of our own, and we always come short. Scientists are not great communicators. They are not. The exception is Richard Feynman. The exception is Carl Sagan, Neil deGrasse Tyson. I think the scientists are gonna have to make sure that when they talk to reporters, they explain themselves and they don't get defensive. One of the biggest problems that I see, for example, in the anti-vaccination movement is the way that they try to debunk these claims while reinforcing them. So it's going to be a problem now of metacognition. It's going to be a problem of presenting evidence in a way that people don't get defensive. And it's mostly going to be a problem that is going to have to deal with the way that we confront ourselves with our own ignorance. Any other questions?
Yes. I was at the skeptic meeting where you spoke, and I think you knew your speaking style was greatly improved.
Oh, nice. It's amazing what no slides can do.
Yes, and a whole room full of people. So, but my question has to do with the scientist gets up and says, well, we need to debunk the pseudoscience skeptical claims. And then there are consumer groups that get up and say, but what about debunking some of the scientific claims when it has to do with certain medicine and vaccinations that have side effects or drugs that have side effects? So, why should our skepticism stop at pseudoscience and not include drug propaganda?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. And it is a problem that I'm appalled by the way the pharmaceutical industry has conducted some of the trials and the scandals that happened thereafter. It's a big embarrassment for people that work in research. Because a lot of us are not really, not making a lot of money, and we get the stigma of a researcher that goes ahead and publishes dubious results. But the problem now is also, and this is a problem, for example, when it comes to side effects, it really depends on what you are studying. If it's the case of vaccines, for example, you have to consider that there's more than one team it's not just people in pharmacy. It's epidemiologists. It's biostatisticians that do different work. It's clinicians. It's public health officials. And some of the computations to decide even something as simple as a vaccine schedule rely on the efforts of large teams of people. And some medicine take 20 years to develop. I don't know if that has an easy answer, but we should never think that we should never have the impression that we shouldn't challenge what looks or appears to be science, at least our orthodox science that is not in the borderline, science that is not that doesn't have demarcation problems. Sometimes that's where we have to look the closest.
That demarcation problem, I think, is a really good term to use, because when some things that are science, the demarcation problems hasn't become an art. It hasn't become science.
I think it never will be, because the problem...
It's art. It's still the science.
And you don't want to kill a science before it flourishes. Also, it can happen. It can stagnate a discipline that has a lot of potential. It happened in chemistry with electrochemistry because of what the Confucian people did.
It's almost like you read my mind on that one. You really were that crossing guy. Oh, it's just a bit of Confucian.
In all seriousness, though, to bring you back to the topic of economics you mentioned, it sounded like you were saying that the great grand years of those patent, almost like then the first person would say, well, maybe a lot of the stuff in economics it's talked about is just bunk too. Well, I mean, in terms of economists discussing this, say, going back to the 40s and 50s, Milton Friedman wrote an article called The Methodology of Positive Economics, in which he went into the whole thing on how you would take Karl Popper's notion of what a testable hypothesis is, et cetera, and then apply that to the whole thing about economic modeling and so forth. And so economists actually been pretty concerned about that, making sure they're not just saying, well, these stats are consistent with this hypothesis. Well, that's necessary, but it's not sufficient. Right? You have to have a testable hypothesis that you could review. So, I mean, they've talked about this for a long time, but to me, it seems the reason why, therefore, nothing has gotten resolved in economics, or at least this continuing debate, is the same problem with cold fusion, same problem with AIDS research, same problem with a lot of drug research and so forth, which, and now global warming, which is to say money and political control. And I'm wondering what your thoughts on that in terms of the clouding effects of money and political control are, in terms of scientists ever really resolving something when too much of that gets into it.
Well, as broad as that question is, there is at least some research that I can recall off the back of my head. They have noticed that at least the better function in democracies in which the standard of living is high, there's enough wealth, and its function in democracies tend to be places where the power is, even though there's always going to be a tendency to divide yourself in right and left politics, the places that tend to do better, those types of elections are more competitive. We started seeing in America the abuses of the left after the hegemony that the Democratic Party got, and it ended when LBJ pissed off a lot of people because he signed the Civil Rights Act and stuff like that. He lost them the South. But corruption was higher and stuff like that. When from the Reagan era till recently, it's been dominated by the conservatives, in part because of their alliance with the moral majority, and then those scandals seem to start popping up more frequently in that party. I think that if we can avoid polarization in some way, that's the best form. Because what's going to happen is that if democracies continue to become polarized on that on some issue, the opposing party tends to stay similar in the way it's distributed, but the people in power then start pushing up moderates, and people that maybe are deciding to do compromise, because why are you going to do a compromise if you don't really have to negotiate? But how do we apply it? You know, what the things that we learn about functioning democracies, or how can we prevent the deterioration of our own democracy? You know, that's a question that we are not even beginning to explore yet. We don't have the data. Should I, are there any more questions?
One more here.
Great, bro, right?
Yeah.
I haven't seen you in years.
I know.
Glad to see you.
I like to engage people in philosophical conversations that don't usually get into it, especially people who call themselves scientists. And in my experience, people who practice science don't seem to conceive of what they're doing as a branch of philosophy. And so I feel like I run into sort of this, it feels like anti-intellectualism to me, and I wanted to see, I mean, what do you think, what does anybody think about that?
A scientist that ignores philosophy is, well, is doing...
They don't think of science as doing philosophy.
Well, before they were called scientists, they were called natural philosophers, right? A scientist that is not incorporated into the thinking, the epistemology, the methods of finding knowledge that were a staple before and from Bacon on, is doing it at its own peril, and it's a real disgrace. It also happened that at the same time, many philosophical schools like relativism also made claims that all knowledge were equal. So postmodernists, there's some schools of philosophy that became very prominent at some time, and those weren't compatible with science as we know it, at least as Popper defined science. But now, that doesn't mean that just because I cannot understand Lacan when I'm doing chemistry, doesn't mean that probably I don't want to pay attention to other methods by Bacon, for example, or at least questioning myself or questioning authority. Because let me tell you something. From my experience, it's not. There's some point where you have to question the authority, and in my case it was my advisor, and he was okay with it, but not everybody else was, you know, I'm never gonna forget him, you know, that he was okay with me saying that maybe that structure that he published was wrong. But the postdocs and other my peers, they wanted me to sweep it under the rug. So it takes some courage too. But I think the other problem is that I think that the philosophy of science either became the philosophy of physics in many ways, and then to a lesser extent, philosophy of biology and stuff like that, and it's underrepresented in other areas, and that's also a problem. It's a way to identify. I think that, for example, a biologist has the origin of the species to stand on as a foundation, and another beautiful form that give it some philosophical pride. The physicists, they have the origin of the universe. They have the strange paradoxes that they see in particle physics. Chemists don't have any, but it's because they, for example, in my discipline, but that's because they're not thinking about the origin of life. There's a lot of philosophical questions there. They should think based on the work of Miller. And that would give them a philosophical pride to stand on. There's only one prominent philosophical philosopher of science, and he's work is devoted to the periodic table. There should be a little bit more than that when it comes to chemistry.
All right, thank you.